Hello, and welcome to the return of the socially distanced Brad Pitt cast. My name is Joseph Earp.
I'm Dan Dixon.
You're Dan Dixon on Zoom again, Dan.
Yeah, I know.
We haven't done this in a long time. A long time.
Yeah, it's been, what, 6 months maybe?
Yeah, something like that. Dan had to make...
For our Christmas episode.
Exactly, I know. Last Christmas we were sitting in the backyard of my old house where I no longer live and eating ice cream and getting, like, haunted by drones. And this year we're in, what, wave three of the novel coronavirus and you're not even in Sydney anymore.
That's right. I made it up to Brisbane. There was no intention on my part to just slip through the cracks, but I flew up just before things went crazy in Sydney, so I managed to beat the border closure, which I am very grateful for. And sorry to anybody who that it couldn't do that. I feel kind of guilty because it's happened twice now. I've managed to come to Brisbane like days before the border was closed. The first time I kind of sensed it was happening, so I booked the ticket, but this time it was entirely luck.
It's also kind of weird that we are now, for our international listeners, hello international listeners, it's weird that we're kind of like, oh, how novel is all this? We can't like hang out and see our friends, and like our poor American listeners have been experiencing this the whole year. It's only us who like have had this experience of like sitting next to one another and coughing on one another and able to go and see Christopher Nolan's Tenet in the cinema. We've had that life. No one else has had that life.
Being in rooms.
Being exactly at the same time. It is sad that it's the Christmas episode that we're like this, Dan. You know, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's always joyful to see your face, but it's
likewise.
It's different.
It is different, and we'll be back. I'm almost certain, given how things are going, we'll be back in person, if not next episode, pretty soon.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true.
But it's a different Brad Pitt cast.
It is.
Definitely an appropriate one to end 2020 on. This is our last podcast of 2020.
Exactly. It feels like we've come full circle. We've gone through the hard parts, and then things got better, and then they got worse, and, you know, what can you say?
We should review the year, I think, at some point.
Oh, 100%.
I want to look back.
It's on my list. I've been reading a lot for my PhD next year, which hopefully is going to happen. That would be very nice. My PhD is going to be about the work of the philosopher Richard Rorty, who is a philosopher kind of famous for like shaking up philosophy in the 80s and 90s and basically saying we can never understand the non-human set of facts. We can never get past contingent, democratically agreed upon reality. We don't have some kind of special insight into how the world really is. We can only talk about socially developed human behaviors. And Rorty has this phrase which I really like. Because of all of that, he can no longer say that like things are good or bad, right? Because his whole point is that we can't see objectivity, so we can't say like, oh, this has turned out well or this has turned out badly. So he has this phrase where he says, by good he means more of what we want and less of what we don't. And I think looking back at the year, we can see the peaks and troughs of the Pitcast is like there have been times where we had more of what we wanted, and sometimes there are times where we had more of what we didn't want. But we survive and we soldier on because we have Brad Pitt with us in our hearts.
And our first entire calendar year of the Pitcast as well, which I think is momentous.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, 100%. We've been doing this for like a year and 2 months, Daniel.
Yeah.
And we're not even close to the end of the films of Brad Pitt.
We're about halfway, I think.
Yeah, we've got the chunk of films that people know him for to do.
Oh, boy.
Which is crazy. That's actually we're not here to talk about a Brad Pitt film. We're here to talk about a Brad Pitt-related film, which is David Fincher's Mank. So shall we do our compact Mank cast first, and then do our year in review and our listener emails and our other bits and bobs?
I think that's a great idea. Mank up front.
When do we bring in the ice creams? Do we do that right now?
We can do ice creams now. Let's do ice creams now.
Okay, we have to both go to our separate fridges.
Decisive. I'll be a moment.
Oh, I will also be a moment. You have a I have a cornetto. Now
I was planning on getting a cornetto, but only drumsticks were sold at my local
Well, I had to get a cornetto because it's a vegan cornetto, and I am committing in a serious way to my veganism in 2021. You have to live.
Practice.
You have to live in a way that you can abide, and it has to be veganism for me personally, I think.
Good luck.
I know. Yes, that's what people say to you when you say you're going to do it. I just wanted to, before we unwrap and begin eating our ice creams, I just have to say, very good friend of the show, Bernhard, requested that in advance we share which ice creams we would be eating on the show, which is a lovely idea. So I kind of did a Twitter update where I just said, on Twitter, attention Pitcast fans, our Christmas episode will drop on Christmas Eve sometime in the morning. We will be eating ice creams as was foretold. In a day or two, we will update this account with news about which ice creams we will be eating so that you can eat them with us. And we got retweeted by Brad Pitt Webb about this, which is an account with 7,200 followers. And they follow us. They followed us from the beginning. And we got three replies to that tweet from people who don't follow us and presumably do not listen to the podcast. So I wanted to read them. One person, Victoria, just said, "Bon appetit," and then emoji, ice cream, emoji, like, tongue out face, like silly face. We got a reply from a Celebrity Ducks Twitter account, which appears...
This is baffling to me.
It appears...
I would encourage people to look at this to see if they can decipher it.
The Twitter handle is @CelebrityDucks, and it's unique collectible rubber ducks by Celebrity Ducks, and they do, like, Harry Potter ducks. Presumably they have a Brad Pitt duck, and that's why they follow Brad Pitt. They replied to us, "Oh, how cool is that? Bad timing for my Chip Celebra duck to have just sold out." And they have a photo of a duck wearing, like, an old-timey ice cream vendor outfit with an ice cream. So I guess it was an attempt to do some kind of native advertising in the replies.
It's now why, because we've talked about it on the podcast.
Exactly. Very successful. How many Pitcast listeners do you think will go out and immediately buy a Celebra duck?
At least one. If you do, send us a picture. Although it's sold out, I guess. Or a Celebra duck of some kind. Maybe not that one.
Yeah, you can't buy a Chip, but according to this website, they have many dozens of different ducks, Celebra ducks can buy.
We do not know enough to endorse, but we'll, But making the moves around the Brad Pitt web, the Brad Pitt ecosystem online, that's really gaining traction.
Exactly. Well, I saved my third and favorite reply for last because someone named Karen, their Twitter bio is just, "I'm honest. I don't lie if people like me for who I am. That's not my fault or my problem." Which is a fantastic Twitter bio. And they replied, "Maybe the sweetest thing anyone said to me personally in my life." This is someone who has never listened to our podcast, knows nothing about us, and went out of their way to write, "I don't eat ice cream, but I hope you enjoy the ice cream that you eat. Don't eat too much ice cream. You will get brain freeze." So, you know.
Thoughtful.
Extremely thoughtful. Have you ever been that thoughtful to a stranger, Daniel?
A true good Samaritan.
Yeah, I've never once said to someone, like, "Look out, be careful." I'm unwrapping my cornetto and it's melting already.
Yeah, well, I'm in 34 degree Brisbane heat today, which is when I'm going to buy this ice cream was, I would say, maybe 3 blocks away, and it was a slog.
Is it really 34 degrees?
Mm-hmm.
That's truly...
Except for ice cream weather.
That's truly hellish. Do you have air conditioning at your house?
Just fans. Always. I'm recording this from my childhood bedroom.
Are you?
Actually. Yeah. But never. We've never had air conditioning. We have a lot of windows and we have fans, but that's the extent of it.
And you have the cool change. Everyone loves the cool change, right? This is what I know.
Yeah. In the evenings, like, you can really... The breeze comes through, especially where we are. And it's very pleasant. But that kind of makes it bearable. Otherwise, it would be impossible, I think.
Do you have any childhood...
Winter weather is tough.
Do you have any childhood mementos around your room? All I can see is lots of bookcases.
Yeah, it's mostly books.
And not...
I've got my...
Not your books as a child?
Extended editions of Lord of the Rings. Some childhood books. I've got a lot of Asterix books. Put ice cream down briefly. I know. I will say that I know a lot of people find eating on podcasts difficult, and to them I say, deal with it. I've got my three Lord of the Rings DVDs.
Oh, originals. Incredible! Incredible.
Also,
Dan has the big, beautiful box set editions of each of the Lord of the Rings movies, the ones with hundreds of hours of special features on them.
Which I loved as a child.
I still love. I find them extremely comforting.
The book of... I just happened to have focused in on the Lord of the Rings section of my bookcase.
Oh, incredible. You had
probably the first big book I read in my life. I read this when I was like 11, Lord of the Rings.
Is that all three Lord of the Rings books in one volume?
Yeah. I got this as a child for some reason. I'm not even...
Ali G? Incredible.
Ali G did. It's all the best interviews.
Incredible. Did you buy that for yourself or was it purchased for you?
I might have bought it myself. My dad really liked Ali G.
Mm-hmm.
If anything else comes to mind during the podcast, I'll bring it out. But I'm not sure that it makes the best audio, but it is nice to look around.
Is
some cricket books.
The best Ali G interview is probably the one where he interviews Noam Chomsky. And when he says linguist, he means like lesbian or something? It's a lot of fun.
And that's right, yeah.
I finished my ice cream already. It was tiny. And it was vegan.
I'm just now. Yeah.
Vegan chocolate is fine. I don't necessarily love chocolate very much, so I don't get funny about vegan chocolate. Vegan cream is getting better all the time. So, like, I actually eat a lot of vegan ice creams because they're always pretty nice. The problem is always, like, ice cream cones, you know? Like pastry-adjacent items just kind of have that slight taste of, like, gluten-free food, you know? It's, like, cardboardy and just is not quite what you want. So that vegan Cornetto cone had an uncomfortable give to it. It wasn't, like, a crunchy cone.
Yeah, it's hard. Baking vegan is pretty challenging, but it's possible. I actually made some good vegan chocolate chip cookies one time, which I'll give you the recipe for. You use flax instead of eggs.
Oh, sure.
Flax, you like blend flax and pour water in it. Anyway.
Yeah.
But it's hard. I've had a lot of vegan and gluten-free baking failures as well, so a challenge.
Deeply challenging. Well, I'm bouncing back. I'm currently drinking some of my favorite stuff in the world, which is this brand of kombucha. We're giving everyone fucking free shout outs. Celebrity Ducks and this brand of kombucha that you can only buy in Sydney, Australia, called Mela Maguire, which is like every other kombucha tastes awful after you've had this one. Like, you know how kombucha kind of tastes? It has like an acidy taste. It tastes like sucking on a mouthful of batteries, and this kombucha has variety and texture to the flavor. It tastes like a drink. In fact, quite a complicated drink. I'm drinking the Jet. You have to go to liquor stores. They don't sell anywhere else. So there's a liquor store.
We're turning into an infomercial channel.
I know we are, but this is important. It also costs about the same as a bottle of wine. For people like me who don't drink, it's easy. But for other people, I'm sure they'd be like, why the fuck would I just not buy a nice bottle of wine? Which is a valid question. Fucking David Fincher's Mank, which we watched.
Oh boy.
We watched together. We have not watched many films in the same room this year, really.
Post-quarantine especially. Obviously during quarantine as well.
But we didn't start up again when we got out of quarantine.
Yeah, what was the last?
We saw New Leaf.
We watched a few films, a couple of films, not for the podcast together, I think. Not many for the podcast. Yeah, it was... this is going to be a strange film to talk about, I think.
By virtue of it just being straight up a strange film. What have you... When we were watching it together, we were both saying, variations of like, oh, I don't know about this bit, but we, there was also stuff that we were enjoying. How has it settled in your memory?
I think it's the kind of film that maybe demands a rewatch, to be honest, which I haven't had a moment for. I should also say, just because you can probably hear it in my voice, I've been sick. I obviously tested negative, otherwise I would have been on the news, but since Mank was the last film I worked before, I kind of like tuned out, and I've been in kind of a weird state.
The both of us, really, Daniel. The both of us.
Yes. And the year is ending as it was.
Yes.
Insanely.
Yes.
I've definitely kept thinking about it. I will say that, which is absolutely not true for a lot of movies I watch necessarily. I think I have a mind, and this might be one of the ways in which we watch films differently. I think I have a mind where I will kind of compartmentalize films unless they're kind of brought up for some reason. One of the reasons why the podcast I think is really good for me as a film watcher is it forces me to attend to films in a way I wouldn't otherwise. But Mank really has just kind of stuck around in my mind, and I keep thinking about sequences from it. I think it's a film that feels a bit like a montage, and a really good montage, but I'm not sure how good a film it is.
I think you're right. I think I haven't, for some time, quite so distinctly had the experience of watching a film and there being parts of it that I really enjoyed and being parts that I really didn't enjoy. And not only, it's rare to, I think, particularly to watch a film by a filmmaker as kind of masterful and as famous as David Fincher, where there are just silly mistakes. That's the thing that I find very hard to square away with Mank, is that I'm used to, when I see a, like, you know, after I saw I'm Thinking of Ending Things, I said to you, it's hard for me to tell you how I feel about that film because there were times I really didn't like it and times when I did like it. And the times where I didn't like it, I never thought Kaufman has just missed something or not thought about something or needed more time to work on something. Whereas there are long stretches of Mank that are just first draft shit. Like, they're not trying for something that they don't succeed. They're just being really lazy.
I think I go back and forth on, obviously, Netflix broadly, I think, is probably on balance is bad for cinema, I think, overall. Even though some really good stuff has come out of it. Netflix in combination with a bunch of other market and kind of factors and other conditions. But I think I go back and forth on, like, how good, for some directors, the freedom Netflix gives them is, and how limiting, like, and how much they just need studio notes. Mm. And Mank did feel like something that didn't get enough notes to some extent. Or, like, suffered from too much freedom of Fincher to kind of overthink himself into oblivion, or the studio being like, do whatever you want with this because you're David Fincher.
There's also the autobiographical element that we have to mention, that this film was written by Fincher's father, who passed away, and they have been working on the script for this film since Fincher made Alien 3, which is his first feature film. So it's been rattling around his head for an extremely long time. And his father is the only credited screenwriter, although it's widely known. I mean, people are openly saying in interviews that it went through a lot of hands, including Fincher's own. Like, Fincher, who is not someone who tends to have much of a role in the writing of the screenplays of his film, apparently tinkered with this one for a long time, especially after his father passed away. And that's kind of wild to think about, because this does not feel like an over-polished film. At times it feels like a rushed, even hurried film. But it maybe explains the film's odd relationship with sentimentality, that its worst parts are very schmaltzy, and maybe if your deceased father, in his only ever credited screenplay, wrote some schmaltzy shit, maybe you're just not very likely to cut that stuff out.
It did feel a bit like that, especially like if Fincher had final control over everything. Because I think there's a few, although I don't know, like, there is something about the directing of this film that felt at odds with its content in a way, which made it feel almost like less auteurish, weirdly. And maybe that's something to do with he doesn't feel like he can change the heart of his father's material too much. It's just some very strange choices, I think, throughout Mank.
Fincher is not the person for this material. I mean, that feels like a crazy thing to say, but he's not. He's meticulous and exacting, and he does all this stuff that's been much talked about, that he puts cigarette burns in the corner and he kind of replicates the filmmaking of the time. But that's not who he is as a filmmaker. He is not an old school golden age of Hollywood guy. He's a 90s exacting, extremely obsessed with visuals guy. Which just means that there are these moments that, to use maybe a phrase that's overused in our contemporary climate, there's just some cringy shit in this movie. It makes me cringe. There's an early car crash sequence that is shot like a 40s car crash with, you know, you don't see it, the car flies off, the camera shakes, and it's fucking sucks. It doesn't work with the rest of the film. It doesn't work with who Fincher is, and it's just kind of embarrassing in a weird way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting talking about silly and cringy stuff, because I actually think, go to the pit films we've watched with Fincher for this podcast, I think Seven and Fight Club are kind of silly, right? Like, there are elements that are really silly in those films. I think that if you look at the kind of, particularly like the design around, I remember, I think it's Seven, there's like, in the opening credits, there's very like 90s kind of Nine Inch Nails-y, maybe there are flying knives, kind of almost this kind of adolescent obsession with shock. And I think obviously it works really well in those films because they have deeper messages and because the form is really well matched to the content. They evoke a world of kind of, they, like, both their worlds are really dark and coherent and grimy in a way that matches the kind of adolescent angsty silliness of them. But Meg just isn't that at all. Especially, like, it seems, it's such a strange thing. I think I like Citizen Kane more than you do. But it is such a strange thing to make a film so contingent on Citizen Kane that is so at odds with itself in terms of its craft and content.
And a film that can't really successfully argue for the importance of Citizen Kane. And I don't know what it looks like to make a film that does, but we were joking while we were watching the film. Imagine being the person who doesn't really know Citizen Kane, doesn't know Orson Welles, and watches this. And you maybe have, I decided in retrospect, a kind of pretty analogous time to the person who does know Citizen Kane. Because this film isn't about a guy writing Citizen Kane. It's about a guy writing a movie. It could have easily been, you know, the writing of Meet the Feebles, a better film than Citizen Kane, you know, and obviously the biographical details of the screenwriter would be different, but the structure of the film wouldn't be different, because you're never,
yeah,
it doesn't tell you anything about Citizen Kane almost at all.
I think one thing you pointed out that is to this film's credit is that it avoids, apart from the very beginning, near the very beginning where you see Mank, the writer of Citizen Kane, writing, I think, the opening of Citizen Kane, like, you see him kind of dictating a description of the opening scene, it basically entirely avoids the process of writing, which I think is almost impossible cinematically. Like, probably the best film that I have, I've almost been a long time since I've seen it, the best film about writing movies is Barton Fink that I have seen, and that is about not writing, right? It, even though it avoids that, it doesn't, I guess it's kind of, it's not even really, it's kind of about the business of cinema more than anything else. Mm. And maybe the politics of cinema, but not in any, like, I should say, I feel like we're starting quite down on this film. I kind of liked it. Like, I didn't have a bad time. There's some really interesting stuff in it, there's some wonderful performances, but it doesn't say anything necessarily quite deep about any of those things, about, like, the conditions of production of cinema, which spends a lot of time talking about.
Which is why it's crazy. I mean, we kind of, I think, almost burst into laughter when it happened, but the final shot of this film is someone standing in front of their house holding an Oscar, doing a warm-up Oscar publicity speech.
Totally insane. Very, like, genuinely the final shot. Filmed with the exact same dimensions you would film an Oscar acceptance speech.
Yeah.
And this film, given that it is a film about the wonder of the movies, and that there's, like, no other films released this year, has a decent shot. Like, will be nominated for Oscars, just for sure. Baffling to me. Like, also makes me want to rethink the entire tone and kind of knowingness of the film.
Mm.
But I'm still kind of unable to do so in any productive way. Like, I'm not sure. Like, you don't do like that. That is a blink. That is like a knowing nod, right?
Is but it?
How is that compatible with the rest of it? Like a quite humorless film.
I don't know if I think that final shot is so winking. Because the film wants to say, so it's the story of Mank, Herman J. Mankiewicz, played by Gary Oldman, who, like, a very smart kind of Hollywood shark who writes the best film of his career in Citizen Kane. And he's been an alcoholic and he's been in car crashes, and there's all kinds of reasons that you eventually learn, many of them extremely flimsy, why he writes something like Citizen Kane. And it is ultimately a story about overcoming something. So I don't know how you read the final shot as anything but like a victory lap, anything but, you know, here he is, he's done it, he's achieved it, he's achieved success, he's been recognized for what, you know, it's fucking weird.
I think then that kind of in some ways affirms some of my feelings about Seven and Fight Club, which are films, again, I quite like. I think I like Fight Club more than Seven, but do trip me up a little bit at their humorlessness. I think, although Fight Club at times is very funny, but even though it has good jokes and kind of a very good comedic performance by Edward Norton, there is a self-seriousness to the, and maybe this is why Fincher can't make money, because he's too serious about cinema. And he, as you say, he's not a Golden Age of Hollywood guy, but there's a story, I think an interview you sent me with Fincher where he's on, maybe Soderbergh, someone's set, and he's like, oh, that light is one, whatever, however you measure light brightness, is like one X too bright. And he's just constantly seeing film that way, of like this set of criteria against which he's evaluating it. And, you know, he reportedly does a lot of takes, and as you say, he's a meticulous perfectionist. And he's kind of making this film about the whims and complexities and mess of Hollywood and all the conditions which cause people to make films that go against the creative process and against perfection and against, like, the artist. And I don't think he quite has a grasp on it.
And I think the meticulousness is part of the problem, because on a recent episode I kind of said, I took umbrage at someone who was trying to say that, like, Fincher is a quote-unquote bad director, and what I said was, you know, you can always trust that everything he's doing on purpose because he's so meticulous. And I do still believe that that's true in every film he's ever made, except for Mank. There is, I mean, I keep gesturing to it, so I guess I should give some examples. Mank is holed up writing Citizen Kane, and he has an assistant who is, he's dictating the film to and is in charge of keeping him sober, played by Lily James. And pretty early in the film, she learns that her husband has possibly been killed in the war. He's gone missing. He was on a boat.
Lost at sea.
His boat has sunk. And Fincher fucks up in two ways. He fucks up in the first way because this happens before we really know who she is, so you don't care at all. She receives a letter, she's very upset, but you obviously don't know him at all, but you also don't know her, you don't know her relationship to him. You have zero reason to give a shit about either of these people. So that's already, when I saw that, I was like, that is a misstep, that's ridiculous, that's schmaltzy attempts to kind of bring the two of them together in a really lazy way. The next fuck up is that the rest of the movie unspools and she never ever returns to her husband again. She never mentions him. She never seems upset. We proceed as though it hasn't happened. And then in something like the second to third last scene in the film, she learns, he's not dead. He's been found. And that's it. So a completely, not only bad, but inefficient. There's Lily James is a pretty good performer. Gary Oldman is great in this film. You could have had their chemistry without this nonsense that feels it for the first time. Really, I mean it. Watching a Fincher film, I just want to say to him, like, what the fuck were you thinking? And I always think he knows what he's thinking, but here I just can't account for it.
It's one of those things where, I think often with Fincher, like, for instance, I find the Kevin Spacey, one of the things we disagreed about in the 7th episode was the Kevin Spacey monologue at the end, right? But I don't think Fincher made a mistake. I think that's the film he was making, right? And I know why he does that, and I understand that it's a super solid execution of the kind of film he's making, and the kind of, like, what he wants from his actors and what he wants from his ad sequence. Something I kept thinking, I can't actually remember if I mentioned this on the podcast so far, but that which you raised that as an issue while we were watching it, the sequence with the kind of weird B, C, F plot with the letter and the husband, and it really made me think about how this feels not just like a montage, but kind of like a television series.
Mm.
Like, it feels like it would have made sense as kind of, maybe that's the Netflix thing as well, that there's increasingly less and less distinction between cinema and television in Netflix's eyes. You're watching it all on the same screen. But there's this sense of this as, like, a beat for episode 4, you know?
Yeah.
That, like, oh, yeah, like, we know this character, this thing's happening, okay, like, this takes my attention, we learn something new about Mank through this. I mean, that's, I think, one of the problems with this film, which you also raised, is, and this is kind of an example of it, is how it kind of only uses women as machines through which men experience character development.
Mm.
And I think what you're getting from that plot, that aspect of the plot, that story, is Mank makes a joke about when she gets the letter, Mank makes some joke about, or like he's talking about how the kind of ship her husband is on shouldn't, like, is either unseaworthy or unfit for war, or particularly vulnerable to a type of German bomber or something. And then she reads the letter, finds out her husband's lost at sea, gets upset, another nurse scolds Mank, I think, or another kind of house servant, something. So I think you see, what the film wants you to see is something about Mank's callousness and humanity, which are these two dueling forces throughout the film. But having said all that, I just don't really think it does. Not, as you said, you don't know anything about these people at this stage, so it doesn't matter. The film doesn't pay enough attention to it to have any emotional, for it to have any emotional resonance anyway. And even given those things, it doesn't really add much to Mank. And there's that other sequence with a friend of Mank's that also makes it feel like this was a 10-hour film that got cut down, or like a 10-hour TV series that got cut to a movie. A friend of Mank's has been like an assistant director or something, and is offered a job making a political film advocating for a political position with which he disagrees, and Mank is a little. If any of our listeners want to count the number of times he said Mank on this episode, seven is what it plays through. Mank is like perturbed by the fact that he's making this movie, and then this friend turns out he has a disease. And then it's threatening suicide. And there's this kind of journey Mank goes on that, again, is kind of another vehicle for Mank's character development. But the film doesn't make you... I wasn't really sure who this guy was the whole time.
No.
You never see him before he starts to be a problem.
No.
I mean, he starts to, like... Like, you never see... He goes kind of careens off the path before you get a chance to see him on the path. And there's quite a lot of that kind of thing in this film.
Yeah,
it really felt like it wanted to be 5 hours, which is also weird for a Netflix film that, like, it could have, I don't know if it needed to, like, I don't know if this would have been a good 5 hour film, but it definitely felt abbreviated.
Yeah,
maybe it was a long script.
I suppose so. Yeah, what you're gesturing towards is that this film's I've seen some people call it the B plot, but because the writing of Citizen Kane itself is so underfleshed, I think it's actually kind of the A plot. Upton Sinclair, the socialist journalist running for the governor of California, which would have been, many people think, rightly or wrongly, a turning point in the history of America. Socialism would have become more mainstream. You know, it was a moment, you know, post-depression, where someone like Sinclair could really sell the message of socialism in America to the American working class. And the whole thing is just a fucking mess. Like, everything is not very fleshed out. Sinclair's political positions are not very fleshed out. Who Sinclair isn't very fleshed out. You see him kind of at a distance at one point. He's talked about as kind of this socialist joke. You eventually learn that Mank is cares a lot about Sinclair's message. In fact, the film wants to suggest that Mank feels like he dropped the ball in regards to Sinclair in a way that the writing of Citizen Kane is an attempt to speak truth to power to make up for a lifetime of kowtowing and allowing people like Sinclair to get pushed around. So the film wants to say that, but that's never fleshed out. You kind of realize that retroactively, and you realize that because that's the only thing that holds the film together cohesively. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of random shit happening.
It's funny, like, it kind of relates back to what you were saying earlier about this film. Like, as someone who had seen Citizen Kane and knew about its creation, and someone who didn't might have fairly similar experiences, it feels like there were two scripts. One written for someone who knows exactly who Upton Sinclair is, maybe has, like, read some of his books, is really familiar with the political environment of the time, is familiar with Hollywood and its machinations, is familiar with the fact that Citizen Kane was based on Hearst. And then a script written for some, like, it was all exposition, people didn't know, for people who just had no idea about any of this data, and that those two scripts were mashed together in a way that displeased both those parties.
Yes.
You know? Like, yeah.
You couldn't, if you are someone who doesn't know who Upton Sinclair is, this film is not helpful to you. It doesn't explain to you really anything beyond a very bare bones biographical sketch. And if you are, as you say, someone who does know a bit more about Sinclair, you're also like, what the fuck is going on here? If he's in this movie, why aren't we seeing him? Why is he always from afar? And again, it comes back to this thing that has kind of haunted me, maybe genuinely haunted me about this film, is Fincher doesn't usually make mistakes like that. And Fincher usually picks a lane. And to be honest, he usually picks the more obtuse, you know, he does the thing that, you know, he's not always looking out for his audience in the way that some filmmakers are. Something like Gone Girl, which is so long and so dark and so bleak. He's not.
I watched that. I have not seen that.
You gotta watch it. It's kind of a summer of a period of his career, I think, for better and for worse. And here, I don't know. He's a sentimental father, you know, who is adapting his own father's work, I guess. That's the only way I can account for such mistakes.
Yeah, it is a film with a fair amount of heart buried in it, I think. I think there is a sense that this film cares a great deal about Mank and cares a great deal about cinema and cares a great deal about, like, kind of clumsily cares a great deal about politics as well, because it does make an interesting effort to talk about class and labor in Hollywood
and Nazis and the American upper class. And
well, it's interesting, I was thinking about what you were saying about Sinclair and how the film presents him, and it more or less, most of the descriptions you get of Sinclair are from people who are against him and branding him as a socialist, and then you get Mag kind of pushing back on that. You only really get to see him in kind of negative space. Like, you can assume he's good because the people attacking him are bad. That's basically how this film operates with politics in general. And it does, like, yeah, you spend a lot of time with the kind of Hollywood power brokers, and what's Hearst's first name? I said Charles?
William Randolph Hearst.
William Randolph Hearst, of course. Yeah, Charles Dance plays at the time, I was getting confused. I thought was a really impressive performance, actually.
Yeah, Dance is incredible.
Dance is so good. There's some great... And he kind of appears more and more towards the end of the film, and there's some good stuff there. You know what? I genuinely think this is one of the hardest films we watch to talk coherently about, because it feels... And I think this would be... I hope less than it seems to me, but I think this would be kind of a challenging film to listen to us talk about, unless you've seen it. Just because it's hard to get a grasp on what it is. Like, it was interesting that when this film first started doing the rounds of festivals or whatever, festival equivalents happened in 2020, people were like, this is really good. And then there was this kind of additional round of people saying it sucks. And I kind of see why, because it feels like a film that you can look at from different angles and have completely different readings on, because it doesn't follow... I'm not even sure where I draw the act structure in this film.
No. And it's, no, there's basically not one. Because you expect it's going to be about the writing of Citizen Kane. And it's not. So the first act is kind of Citizen Kane adjacent. Second act is Upton Sinclair. Third act is an attempt to synthesize those two things. And it just kind of doesn't. It just kind of doesn't. But you do mention, and I'm aware that I sound very hard on this film, but you mentioned some things that are extraordinary in this film, right? There are sequences in this film that I believe are some of the sequences of the year, and in particular, it's the one you kind of glancingly mentioned just then. There is a disastrous kind of dinner party which Mank is at, where he's extremely drunk, and he's basically retelling the story of Hearst to Hearst while surrounded by all these other people trying to embarrass him. Because I guess this is the context we have to give. William Randolph Hearst was a very famous tycoon of the time who Citizen Kane is based on pretty openly. And it was, it's a story about a guy who has achieved all this stuff, but is deeply hollow inside. So the film is pointed against Charles Foster Kane, who's the character in Citizen Kane, and against Hearst as a person.
I was just that Hearst had a wife who he tried to get into Hollywood and make a star, and also had wanted to get into politics himself, which are both things dealt with in Citizen Kane, and this film spends some time trying to kind of deal with the realities of that.
Yeah, and it comes to a head in this dinner party where Mank is, telling a kind of jovial story about Hearst, in which it initially sounds like he's talking about Upton Sinclair, because he's saying, like, you know, this leftist socialist hero, a communist, and then it turns out that he's talking about Hearst, who had an ideological shift over the course of his life. And it's a long sequence, and you keep cutting back and forth between other things, and, like, Mank vomits, and then Charles Dance as William Randolph Hearst kind of talks to him and tells him another story, a fable of the organ grinder's monkey, which brings out the theme of the film of kind of abuse and manipulation and the artist being exploited for money and who's actually doing the exploiting, blah, 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 blah. And it's just an excellently performed scene. Oldman is incredible. Charles Dance is incredible. The writing is really good. The film is finally clear-eyed about its major themes in a way that's for me personally, too little, too late. I need those things to be set up more elegantly than just having a scene where two characters just say what the film is about. But it's an excellent sequence. I was sitting there. I had the weird experience of, after sitting there for quite a long time, being like, I don't know about this film. Just thinking, oh, am I watching a masterpiece? And I'm not, but I can see the masterpiece it could have been in that sequence.
Definitely. I think there are a lot of quite good two-person sequences in this film, like Gary Oldman and one, like, talking to someone.
Mm.
Those are normally, and a lot of that is to do with the majesty of Oldman's performance, I think. But there's also that sequence where he, and who's the actress who plays Hearst's wife?
Let me look it up. Hearst's girlfriend, I think, rather than
girlfriend. Wife. Oh, okay.
I think. I might be wrong. Oh, Amanda Seyfried. She plays Marion Davies.
Yeah. She's very good in this.
Yeah.
The scene where she and Mank leave the dinner party together and kind of wander through what I think is the grounds of Hearst's castle.
Mm-hmm.
Which is literally, I think Hearst's castle is literally Hearst's. It's built this huge place he had built for himself in California. And there are these kind of animals in the background, like it's kind of good, like a zoo for grounds. And the film is black and white, but it maybe feels like the sun is rising, or the kind of lighting is quite beautiful. That, I think those sequences as well are when Fincher's directing really works, because his kind of precision is really matched to the quickness or heartfeltness of the conversations at hand. Whereas when he's trying to, well, like, I would say, that, as you said, the one exclusion would be this kind of big dinner party, but that's kind of just almost an Oldman monologue. But there are some kind of, I don't know if like the car crash, I don't know if I call them action sequences, but these more complicated sequences, where Fincher is making this like, as you say, he's got cigarette burns. He's making this kind of old movie in the style of an old movie. He's making this film in the style of an old film, kind of, which, again, I'm not really sure why, right? Like, what, okay, I get that we are making a film about old cinema, old golden age of Hollywood, but why does it have to be?
Yeah.
Like, what does that tell me? You know, what does that add? It feels like something that was pitched at the beginning but never thought about again and just done. But then Fincher will have all his, like, extremely modern 90s, almost like music video techniques, like these kind of, like, quite complicated camera movements, or there's a slickness to it. That's all I can say, I think. There's kind of a slickness to both the lighting and the way in which the camera captures people in relation to each other.
Yeah.
It just feels totally out of time.
Yeah.
So it really is a clash.
Yeah. And not a happy clash either. When I was thinking about who is the filmmaker better suited for this material, I thought about the person I always think about because he's one of my favorite artists and he should do everything, I think. But Todd Haynes, director of Safe, director of Carol, director of Far From Heaven, he's a kind of almost hackneyed choice for this film because he's famously good at adopting a cinematic mode and then subverting it from inside, which he did with Douglas Sirk melodramas when he made Far From Heaven. That's a film that, like, wants to kind of unpack the metaphors as it's using them in a really interesting way. But I think he would also work for a material like this in a way that Fincher doesn't, is that Haynes is very good at the magic trick of keeping things at arm's distance and being quite cold and cynical while also somehow being sentimental. And the example I always think of is, you know, a film that, you know, is like one of the top five films ever made for me. It's Todd Haynes' Safe. That's a film that is simultaneously making fun of its protagonist in a way that is using her as a kind of cruel way to unpick narcissism in the health industry, and also really cares about her. You're also really sad for her. There's an extraordinary sequence at the end of Safe where I think about all the time where she kind of has to give a speech, and she just kind of can't do it. She's standing there, she's giving this long, rambly speech, and everyone starts so, like, happy for her, and the enthusiasm wanes a bit as she just kind of can't get her words out in a coherent way. And it's both barbed and satirical and genuinely kind of sad.
And heartfelt.
Heartfelt, yeah, for real. It's for real. And Mank can't do that. Mank is trying to be sincere in its irony, and it fails in both of those things.
It's really... the thing is, after all this, I would still recommend it, I think. I would still say it's worth watching. Like, not rush out and see it, but it's a good film on Netflix, you know?
Yeah.
And there are a lot of good performances, and some of it is quite beautiful. And it's like, what, 2 hours, 10 minutes? Like, it's not overlong. It doesn't feel overlong, no, necessarily. It keeps moving. It's also, like, there's nothing I love more than, like, a Hollywood backlot where some men are moving, like, weird large props in the background.
Yeah.
I could watch that forever, you know?
Yeah.
And there's a bunch of that. It's fun. It's a reasonably fun film.
We were never bored. We watched it together. We clipped along. We didn't talk much. We weren't, like, distracted. We watched the film. And that's more than you can say about a lot of content these days, quite genuinely, you know?
Definitely.
So, I don't know. Should we do a truncated version of the Letterbox game?
Yeah, let's. I would guess, I haven't looked, my guess would be like 3.8 for Mag. What do we got?
3.5.
That's interesting.
I gave this film 2.5 stars. And that's what I do as a kind of cop-out. Of, like, you know, lots of good stuff, lots of bad stuff. What the fuck can we say? Friend of the show, Desi, gave it 3 stars.
I think I would give it 3 stars.
Really? Friend of the show, Xavier Rubetsky Noonan gave it 3 stars. Past guest, Sam Twyford Moore gave it 3 stars. So, people are pretty torn, I think. I want to just quickly read a review from my friend Alyssa, who has an excellent top four films. Where are they? Alyssa's top four films are In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar Wai film. Great Collars, you said in a recent episode. Daisies, which I told you about. You should see. It's the Czech New Wave feminist film. Really good.
That's right.
Inherent Vice. Paul Thomas Anderson's Inherent Vice. Which I need to see again. I haven't seen that film in a long time.
I'm sure I've said this before, maybe more than once on this podcast, but my feeling I remember coming out of that film is that's the. I must forget, if I were to list PTA's films, I think I would forget that 9 times out of 10. But just because it does, I don't know why. I guess it's not in his like. And What We Love the Most. And Phantom Thread feel like such a trilogy, you know, like it almost kind of consumes it. I remember the feeling walking out of that was the best possible film you could make of a Thomas Pynchon novel, and you cannot make a film out of a Thomas Pynchon novel. I think that was my feeling, basically.
I think I remember being kind of underwhelmed by it, but yeah. So many people I love are in part of a really concerted effort to reclaim it in a way that makes me want to just like give it some time again and see how I feel.
I mean, as a pitch, like Pynchon, PTA, and Joaquin Phoenix is like
incredible.
I'm like, oh my goodness, you know, mind blowing.
Do you know
I think maybe that's why I was underwhelmed because it's such promise.
Do you know that Joaquin Phoenix is going to be the star of Ari Aster's next film?
I didn't know that. That's exciting.
That's a good team up, I reckon. It's Ari Aster's 3-hour nightmare comedy, is what he's describing it as. So, sounds pretty good. And Alyssa's fourth favourite film is Celine and Julie Go Boating, the Jack Rivette film.
Yeah.
Have you seen that? 3-hour long, surrealist caper that I've never seen, but I know everyone thinks is just literally top 10 film ever made. People are obsessed with that movie. Alyssa gives the film 2.5 stars and says, gimmicky and mostly exhausting. And I think I agree. I certainly sometimes feel a little exhausted to talk about it.
Have you ever written Sean Nye?
Say again?
The literary theorist. Sean Nye, the literary theorist. S-I-A-N-N-E-N-G-A-I. I think you would really like her, actually. I think she's entirely your jam. She's really, really smart. One of the best literary studies people currently working. Has three books, Ugly Feelings. The first one is Zany, Cute, and Interesting. We do our aesthetic categories. And I think you'd really like, Zany especially would be a chapter you would like. She talks about Jim Carrey. Oh. But her latest one is Theory of the Gimmick. And she writes about the gimmick as this like capitalist device that conceals its making and that the recognition of which kind of excludes you from being caught out by it. It's really interesting. But I think you're calling Matt gimmicky, which I think it is, made me think of Nye. Huh. There's a good profile of her in The New Yorker recently, actually. But I think she would be, like, I think Ugly Feelings would be a really good place to start. Incredible book.
I don't know it at all.
And just like, yeah, she's so cool. Very cool.
I'll read it. That sounds good. I need to... I'm just literally all I'm fucking reading is Richard Rorty at the moment. I need to like give Dickie a break for a little while and read someone else. Should I? Is this just such a fucking insular story to tell? I think I just have to tell it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Richard Rorty. One of the many things that I love about Richard Rorty, who died many years ago. Not that many years ago. I think in the 2000s. He had a really thick Midwestern accent, a real kind of drawl. And there's an excellent interview that you can watch of him talking, where he's talking about truth, his theories of truth. And he kind of ends a sentence by saying this thing that now me and my fellow philosophy nerds always say to each other when we're wrapping a conversation up. He would always say, and that's about all we can say about truth. And he's got like real bad vocal fry. And so now whenever we're wrapping a conversation up, so before we segued into the letterbox game, if I was with my philosophy nerd friends, I would have said something like, and that's about all we can say about Mank, just as a way of being like, let's move on. Anyway, so his voice is very distinctive. And I was recently told this story of when he came to Sydney University in the late 90s. And he gave a talk. And the talk finished and it was question time. And philosophy question time is known for being very brutal. People are trying to shame you, trip you up very publicly. It can be like very cruel. So this philosopher stood up in question time and went on like a 15-minute rant against Rorty, just being like, you use the word romanticism, you don't understand, here's the history of romanticism, just going on and on and on, really trying to be like, you don't even understand, this is how you're misusing that phrase. And apparently Roddy just like let the guy talk for 10, 15 minutes and then sat there and thought about it and rubbed his chin and was like, you know, I maybe shouldn't have used that word. And then that was it. Like, that's how to be a philosopher. Just don't give a fucking shit. Whatever. Okay, fine. So anyway, that's my Dickie Roddy story.
I respect that enormously.
I do too. This last Mank review is the last one I think we should do is by my friend Kai, who we've talked about before. As always, his top four films are Totally Inscrutable. I have seen I've seen one of these films. The first is Jean Roland's The Iron Rose. He's a horror, romantic horror director who would like make vampire, sexy vampire movies in big old castles throughout the 70s. The Emperor's Naked Army Marches On, which is a documentary about a 62-year-old survivor of the battlegrounds of New Guinea in World War II who gained notoriety by slingshotting steel pinballs at Emperor Showa to protest against what he considered to be the ruler's war crimes. So,
jeez.
Sounds good, but how many people have logged it on Letterboxd? 2,000. So, no one's seen this fucking film. Love Letters, directed by Amy Holden-Jones, who made Slumber Party Massacre, which is great. This is her one other film that's not part of the Slumber Party Massacre series. And Last House on Dead End Street, which is a famous, notoriously unpleasant 70s horror film that was released anonymously and which many people at the time thought was a real-life snuff film. It's like people thought people were really getting murdered. And the director...
Which of those... films are you saying?
That one, Last House on Dead End Street. It's like 70 minutes long and it's so gross. It really is a film that, like, not only because horrible things happen in it, but it really just does, just the whole aesthetic is so grotty. Really a place where you and I probably are most similar is when I see a film like that, because just too unpleasant even for me. I just go,
wow.
Did I enjoy it? I don't know. I certainly didn't have a good time.
I think also, I think to riff on our kind of ongoing conversation, our extended conversation about horror and violence and unpleasantness in cinema, I think I obviously have not seen that film and probably never will, but I feel like people who hate horror or people who find horror unwatchable, I mean, people who find horror immoral, let's say, I think often think, all horror is what I imagine that film is.
Sure.
Because I think when I started, I mean, obviously I've never, I think there was definitely a time in my life where I hadn't watched much horror films. I'd watched some fairly confronting films, but I'd never watched horror. And I don't think I quite held that position. But I think one of the things about watching more and more horror films with you, or just in general, is I'm like, oh, most of them have kind of moral centers and aren't actually that bad. Like, they won't show you anything, and they won't just be cruel to the audience. And, like, as we discussed in our last episode, I think Babel is, like, significantly more immoral and more cruel to the audience than probably, like, 95% of horror films.
Yeah. Most horror films don't go there. They really don't. And yeah, they cut away almost always before what you think is going to happen is going to happen. Except Last House on Dead End Street. Kai's review of Mank. Interesting to see what you'll think about this. Fincher has always been irony poisoned, but he puts so many quotation marks around this material that it might as well not exist. Now that's a take on what's going on in this film that lends more credence to Fincher than I think I probably feel. I don't know if he's putting quotation marks on purpose.
I think Seven and Fight Club are two of the most earnest films we have seen.
Mm.
And I think Fight Club is earnest in its kind of condemnation of the culture that it's representing, while it still finds it a little cool, right? Like, it's broadly condemning toxic masculinity. And Seven is, like, very into being this kind of film about psychopathic, gritty, New York underground streets kind of thing. That's kind of, like, general darkness, kind of a bit, yeah. Biblical horror. I think Mank's pretty sincere. That didn't occur to me. That never occurred to me watching it. I don't think Fincher is that I want to use a better word than sophisticated, but I just don't think he's operating on that level.
It leads us to ask questions that I don't think I can answer very well about, like, what the fuck is going on with that final shot? Because I'm sure Kai is thinking that that's ironic, and although I'm always willing to say, like, Fincher usually knows what he's doing, I don't know what the fuck is going on there. It's not coherently ironic to me. I think maybe David...
It doesn't feel knowing.
No.
I mean, I said that early on because it's the only... If someone was doing it with deliberately, as Fincher does, it would feel that way.
Yeah.
But, I think I agree with you ultimately that, like, it doesn't... Because if it is ironic, it just doesn't fit in with the rest of the film at all.
No.
It's like a weird bolt from nowhere.
No. Mank. Weird movie. I give it 2.5 Manks out of Mank.
I think I give it 3 Manks.
Okay. Are we ever going to use the Mank scale for anything else? Probably not. It has to be like what Wittgenstein would call a private language, right? We just need to be... Mank can only be described by Mank. It's self-referential.
Exactly.
We can't say
anything. It's internally coherent and doesn't function outside itself.
Exactly. Shall we wrap up our year?
What a year it's been. What was the... Maybe I should bring this up. What was the first film we did? When did we start this year with?
Fuck.
Sorry.
No, it's an excellent question. It's embarrassing to me that I don't know off the top of my head.
I will say, we tend not to talk about numbers, but I feel like we have gained a solid listenership.
We got an email.
Over the course of this year.
We got an email saying we're very popular in the People's Republic of Korea.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, it just came in just very recently.
Oh wow!
I'm spending time. What must it have been? Oh Christ, we were doing. Oh, it was The Favour.
Oh, funny. That's right.
That was on 4th of January.
Had been in America, or was that? That was just before I went to America.
It was. Yeah, it was just before. And you know what? I've said it before. I'll say it again. The Favour, one of our best episodes. I really think that. It's really funny, and not enough people have listened to it because no one knows that film. So go and listen to it.
I barely know that film.
I know, and you are one of three people in history who has watched it. No, that's a good episode. We're funny on that episode. We're not often funny, Daniel, but we are on that one.
We're ranked 15th in film reviews in the Republic of Korea.
Oh, we are. Fucking killing
above it. Above where we're ranked in Australia, anyway. We don't even go into that. That's wild.
That's very funny. What do you think, not to put you on the spot, what do you think is the best Brad Pitt film that you've covered this year? That we have covered? What's the best and what's the worst?
I'm just looking at our list of films we've done.
I think we know what the worst is, right? I don't...
Legends of the Fall, right?
Ocean's 12, I think.
Oh, Ocean's 12, of course. Sorry, I'm looking up back further. Yeah, definitely. Well, did I say Babel? I think I said Babel was the worst movie I've ever seen. We had a couple, but Ocean's 12... If I had to watch one of those again, it would actually probably be Babel.
Do you think?
Because there's stuff in Babel that I can deal with. I found Ocean's 12 so boring.
Yeah.
I just found that... I think I watched it in, like, 7 chunks. Like, I... that incredibly challenging.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think the best film we have covered this year is not the same as the best Brad Pitt film. I mean, we covered Friday the 13th Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan, and Nixon.
A wonderful film.
Which are just
two. And I'm Thinking of Ending Things.
And yeah, some great films.
Husbands.
We
did Husbands.
Yeah, we did Husbands not that long ago, Daniel.
Yes.
What's the best Brad Pitt film then?
You know what? I think it's probably... This kind of surprises me saying it. I think it's probably Fight Club.
Hmm. You liked it. You liked Fight Club more than Interview with a Vampire? Because you did also like that film.
Yeah. I think I did.
Hmm.
I did like Interview with a Vampire. I think I've seen that like 3 times now. But I think, you know, Ocean's 11 also, very solid film. You know what I was just doing? I was just staring at Confessions of a Dangerous Mind and was like, what was that? What's that film about? I really do not have a good memory for film.
I think the best film that we've covered this year, and the best Brad Pitt film. And I know what you're going to say, but it leads me to a nice personal anecdote. I think the best Brad Pitt film that we've covered this year, one of the best films of his career, is Meet Joe Black. I think that's a very special film. I was talking to how can I delicately phrase this? It's a time of personal transition for me. Lots of people go through these personal transitions. I'm going through a personal transition, and so I'm not sleeping a lot, and so I'm talking to American friends who I have, because the time zone means that now I can like talk to them for much longer than I would usually. And I was talking to a friend the other day who was asking about the podcast and said, this is a make or break question. What do you think about Meet Joe Black? And I was like, I think it's a masterpiece. And this person was like, I do too. And I was like, yeah, fucking tell my co-host that. Because we have like 3.5 hours on record of me trying to convince him that it's a special and important film.
Also a remote episode.
Yes.
From memory. Two remote episodes.
God.
I think I could be convinced. I would be really interested in what my experience is if I go and watch that movie in the cinema.
Sure.
Because I don't think I could ever be convinced that Meet Joe Black is a masterpiece. I think that is beyond my character. But I didn't love it, and I thought some of it was very silly, and I thought it was not particularly compelling for a lot of it, and not really like didn't work, you know, in on its own terms. I can imagine having a really good time at the movies watching that film. I can imagine if I was in a darkened theater and I knew it was a long, well, this long weird film, what is it? Like not knowing much about it. I think for the most part, and I've talked before about like how consuming art for the purpose of doing something with it sometimes makes me like think about it very differently. I think for the most part, I have a better time with films because I'm watching them for the podcast. Now, especially, I think more and more as we get further into Pitt's career. I think Meet Joe Black suffered for that. I also don't know how good I felt Brad Pitt's performance was. I felt it was like lesser performance.
I have to wrap you up here, Daniel. I can't. Now you're on Zoom, I could just mute you if I wanted to. I don't have to fucking put up with any of this shit. He's amazing. It's a great film. You listen to us have that back and forth for 3.5 hours. If you so choose. I mean, last time we also talked about like what are our favorite films of 2020, and I've seen like 5. It's not a very... Yeah. I could probably rank every 2020 film that I've seen.
Yeah, what...
I think I'm going to do that.
For me, if I'm thinking of ending things.
Is number one.
And then... I don't think I've talked about this on the podcast. I saw the Australian film Baby Teeth at the cinema. The only film I saw at the cinema this year, possibly. Baby Teeth and Tenet. And Tenet... I saw someone... I have been on Twitter a lot outside of there, actually. But I saw someone on Twitter the other day say something like, oh, if you say the sound mix in Tenet was bad, it's only because you read something about it being bad and like didn't see it at the cinema. And they got like a lot of likes, and people were doing, like a lot of Nolan fanboys. I saw that movie at a real big cinema. Had heard nothing about the sound mix. I have seen other Christopher Nolan films. The sound mix in that film is intolerable. You cannot understand what people are saying. 25% of the time, could genuinely come out of that movie wondering if you needed to see an ear doctor. Because you're like, what's wrong with me? It's like one of those ads on the sides of buses that are like, is this blurry? You should see an eye doctor that is intentionally blurry.
Yeah.
That made me so mad.
That's very funny.
I didn't even know in what area of Twitter it was circulating if you didn't see it.
No, I didn't see it. That's extremely amusing to me. People, I just think I'm at the stage where I find that like Christopher Nolan can't sound mix his movies. So funny. It just really makes me laugh so much that every single time a Christopher Nolan film comes out, everyone's like, we can't understand
what is happening in your film. And if you're maybe any other filmmaker on the planet, except for like Quentin Tarantino, maybe someone sits you down and says like, listen, you'll stop making movies if you keep doing this fucking shit. But because he's Christopher Nolan, no one can stop him. He could make it more unintelligible and his films would still have like $50 million opening weekends. Like, he's unstoppable.
Yeah.
It's just so funny to me. I want to rank all 14 films I've seen this year. Is that all right with you?
Please. Yeah, I'd love that.
It's crazy. Last year I saw 210 2019 films, and this year I saw 14, 15.
Wow.
Yeah, and most
I think it's not just a function of COVID, right? I think you are watching fewer contemporary films. Maybe watching fewer films in general.
I think I have maybe even said this on the podcast. I really, really just made the deal with myself that I was not going to watch films to keep up with the culture anymore. I just wasn't. I know what I like. I know what I'm interested in. And a couple of these were films.
Chopping Mall,
exactly. I like Chopping Mall. There are lots and lots and lots and lots of films like Chopping Mall. I can just watch those. I don't have to fucking drag myself to see. What did I make myself watch this week? Minari. That, you know, like A24 lilting heart film.
Why do you want to see that?
Fucking, it's just not my cup of tea. It's just not my
when
cup of
tea. Where did you
see it? I cannot say.
Oh, sure. Okay. That's fine. But it's not, you wouldn't, because I know, I thought that was a film that seemed, I thought that might be good. I mean, I might still like
it. I'm sure that people will really like that film. I'm sure Richard Brody at the New Yorker will be ecstatic. It will get glowing notices. People will.
Who knows? Richard Brody is not
the. That's true. Brody was a bad person to pick for like an
A.O. Scott, maybe.
A.O. Scott, for sure. The films I saw this year were David Fincher's Mank. Borat's subsequent movie film, which I gave 4 stars to, one of the best films of the year. Freaky, starring Vince Vaughn.
Oh yeah,
we talked about
great
it.
Film.
3.5 stars. I quite like that one. I'm Thinking of Ending Things. 4 stars. I watched a 42-minute long Netflix documentary called The Speed Cubers, which is all about people who can solve Rubik's cubes really quickly. That was fine. It was okay. I watched Tiger King. I didn't like it very much. Also, doesn't really count as a movie. I watched My Octopus Teacher, a Netflix documentary about a guy who falls in love with an octopus, which I kind of liked, but it's not amazing. The Invisible Man. Lee Whannell's The Invisible Man. One of the genuinely great films that came out this year that any other year would stand toe-to-toe with the best films of the year. But it's kind of done a whatchamahoozie, a Stephen Bradbury or whatever, and just like skated to the position of one of the best films because there's nothing else. And now we're just in films that don't really count as, shouldn't even really be here. 000, the miniseries. I loved that. It was so, so fucking good. I like.
Remind me what that is. You told me about this.
It's about the drug trade, and it's 3 tiers of the drug trade. It's like buyers, sellers, and the American money. And it's just so good. One of those things. You would really like it. It's beautifully shot. It's incredibly acted. It's quite violent and quite cynical, but not in a way that you would find unmanageable. And then like Sun Gazer, which is a short film that I funded on Kickstarter. A short film called Former Cult Member Hears Music for the First Time, which is terrible. Josephine Decker's Shirley, which is that film about Shirley Jackson, which is the worst film of the year. A documentary about Paul Schrader, and a short film called Goldman vs. Silverman, which stars one of the directors of Uncut Gems and Adam Sandler as warring people covered in paint. And then the 2 best films of the year, IMO, Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor and The Nest, starring Jude Law. And those are my 2 favorite films of the year. You would really like The Nest. Have I ranted to you about that film?
What's The Nest? Is it, where do I watch it?
American YouTube. Maybe Australian YouTube now as well. It's Jude Law and Carrie Coon, that very good actress, who play a American couple who pick up sticks and move to a very big English country house. While their finances are falling apart, And the masterstroke, which is such an obvious masterstroke, you just wonder why people haven't been doing it for a very long time, is it's a drama. There's nothing supernatural whatsoever. It's just a drama, but it's shot like a haunted house movie. So it's just this creeping sense of dread. Nothing ever happens. There's no violence. And what it's attempting to portray is like the way that when you're in a bad relationship or a bad living setup, your life just feels bad in the way that horror movies feel bad. So it's just like an extremely simple artistic masterstroke that carries it through like 98 minutes of extremely well-performed tension. It's just great.
That sounds good.
One of those films that just disappeared. It came out months ago and just disappeared.
Which is also weird because you would think coming out in 2020, I guess, no one's watching movies, but you think there'd be a way of making a film like that popular, right? Like, given that there's barely any contemporary content, people are, like, desperately wanting new things.
Particularly because I keep waiting for other people to catch on the way that I've caught on to Jude Law, who's always been one of my favourite actors, but he's just having a moment. He's, like, all of his... He's not picking exclusively great films, but he's great in everything that he's in like a really exciting way. I just feel like one of the best performers currently working is just making movies that people aren't paying attention to, which is weird because he's like famous. People fucking know who Jude Law is.
He's a genuine household.
Yeah. Have you seen Vox Lux?
No.
I don't like that film very much, and it's like one of the greatest performances of all time, his turn in that film.
Yeah, I think I was interested in that film, but it just seems too too cynical, romanticized.
It's deeply
grim.
It's grim and cynical. It's an attempt to do Michael Haneke, directed by someone who has been himself directed by Michael Haneke. So, it's a pastiche, basically. But Law is incredible. He plays like a scuzzy manager, and he's just so fucking good. I think he's hotter now that his hairline has gone weird in the way that it's gone than he ever was when he was a pretty boy. And he's a better actor.
Also really funny. I think Jude Law doesn't get enough credit for being funny.
Yeah, I agree. It's just a shame he has to
really do... Good at the,
really good in what?
The Young Pope.
Oh, don't even get me started. He's unbelievable in The Young Pope. He's so good.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. There was a new fucking series of The Young Pope this year. And it was really good and just doesn't exist. No one said a fucking word about it. We live in oversaturated times.
I mean, really, one of the things I did while not feeling great was, I was like, oh, one of my favorite television series of all time is The Thick of It, the Armando Iannucci political comedy. I just absolutely love it so much. Love it as a teen. Very committed to it. And I was like, I know I've heard bad things, but I should at least give Avenue 20, it's his new space film, space television series on HBO. I should at least give it a try. It's not good. I've only watched like the first episode. Not very good. HBO is making a second season for some reason.
Yeah.
I feel like it made me realize that three television series this year came out about people in space. There's the Tim Heidecker one, there's that one.
The Tim Heidecker and then, one.
Space Force with like Steve Carell.
Yeah.
There is a lot of content being produced at the moment. I know no one who has seen any of those.
No.
And then, not like that my circle is the measure of what is being watched, but I feel like any of those things being made, people would be having like significant conversations about them. Like people are talking about them on Twitter, anywhere.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And it seems like part of the thing that you're one of two fates when you make a TV show is either everybody sees it or literally nobody does. There's no middle ground anymore. There's no, like, quasi-successes. There's just these shows that, like, literally have zero cultural impact.
Yeah, you're either the Queen's Gambit or Tiger King, or you are nothing.
And there's a possible world very close to us where the Queen's Gambit, it doesn't exist.
Yeah,
where someone's definitely like one person who you vaguely know is like, oh yeah, I watched this show about some chess person and it was like pretty good. Like it's there's no measure of success one way or the other anymore. Like I always think about it is weird, but there's that show
On Becoming a God in Central Florida that came out this year, that's Kirsten Dunst playing, like, a cult member. And I just think, in another world that we used to live in, just there would just be an audience for that show, no matter how weird it is. Because I can just say to you, you know her, here she is, it's kind of funny. Like,
yeah.
And there's just not anymore. Or there is a massive audience for it, and you can't tell which one.
I also feel this only happened maybe like 3 or 4 years ago. I could be wrong about that, but I feel like up until then, everyone was like, people were watching all, like you'd see the top 10 list of TV shows at the end of the year, everyone had watched them all. Was broadly the same set of things, and then everything just seemed to flatten out.
Mm-hmm.
And then there'd be these spikes like Tiger King or whatever.
Where,
but just for some reason, everyone watches.
Yeah, everyone watches. And I mean, I'm in the content business, right? And there are a lot of these shows, so I'm always fucking looking for, like, what's the Netflix show that everyone is talking about. But there's even more shows that, like, are never ever getting seen. You know what I mean? It's like, you could be in the churn and think, like, wow, Netflix is doing great. Like, look at all these fucking shows I'm writing about. But you're dealing with the tip of the iceberg, and there's shows that you don't even know exist that just, like, I say it all the time, and I won't even be able to remember what it's called. Apple TV launched with a massive Game of Thrones-style fantasy show starring Jason Momoa that costs something like $40 million an episode, and to say it has no cultural impact is an insult to cultural impacts. It does not exist. It does not exist.
I saw trailers for that.
What's it fucking called? Yeah, like, C or something?
I don't think I'm some kind of sage. Give almost anyone money to watch those trailers and be like, oh, this will not do well.
Yeah.
Like, I could have told you that. It just felt like Apple TV. I feel like there's some people watching the Jason Sudeikis, like, football coach.
Yes. Series. Ted Lasso or whatever the fuck.
Apple TV. But I feel like for the most part, you can see these, like, see the marketing campaigns, you're like, no one's going to watch that.
No.
Just immediately, you know, and then it crashes.
No. Oh, and yeah, absolutely. Not only is there so much content that no one watches, there's a lot of content that people watch and tell you is the greatest thing ever, and then it fucking disappears. Like, everyone was telling me to watch that show by the creator of Chewing Gum. What's it called?
I May Destroy You.
I May Destroy You. It was everywhere. Everyone was like, this is the greatest thing. And now it's fucking disappeared. It doesn't exist. No one talks about that show.
I watched like half of that. It's pretty good, I will say. I have some issues with it, but broadly I think it's pretty good. I watched Rami this year, the Hulu show. I've recommended that to a few people and found a surprising number of people who watched it. It's been renewed for, I think, a third and fourth season. It won awards. Like, that won some Golden Globes or whatever. You win as a TV Emmys, something. But even, those are weird. Like, those, it's as if I have, there's like 1,000 possible shows. I happen to have picked this one.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm one of its half a dozen watchers.
Yeah.
I think Rami is a genuinely good show.
It's
actually so surprising. It's one of the only shows I've ever watched that, or one of the, like, that is, I guess this is kind of a spoiler, for its gradual arc, which is very gradually over the course of the 2 seasons, you realize the main character might just be a jerk, which is really interesting, actually. And, like, very rarely, like, he's not, like, on some path to redemption. He, like, kind of gets worse and starts out as, like, a nice guy and then just becomes, and he's genuinely, like, there are some good episodes and some really terrible episodes, but I will endorse Rami as one of my 2020.
I think the one that I'm, like, singing to whoever will listen, and not because it's great, but just because, like, I feel like I need other people to bear witness. There's a Foxtel show called The Third Day, which stars Jude Law, speaking of Jude Law, and it's, like, it's basically The Wicker Man. It's, like, a contemporary Wicker Man, but it was shot in this really weird way that it's Jude Law's storyline, which is called, like, Autumn. And then there's another full-length storyline that takes up the second half of the season, which deals with the same island. And in the middle, in between them, there is a episode that was filmed as a 24-hour live theatrical experience, which meshes the two storylines. It was just filmed on some island. It was shot all in one take. Florence Welch of Florence and the Machine is there. It's like, the whole thing is fucking crazy. And made crazier by the fact that I have not met a single other person who's watched it. Like,
I'm looking it up, what's it called?
The Third Day. Created by two people who kind of, like, don't really exist themselves.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it came out, like, a month ago. Yeah, September to October. And just, like, yeah, just doesn't fucking exist.
Wow.
So, you know. Peak TV.
Yeah, never heard of it.
You should watch it, it's pretty good.
Something like that.
I still think that we should do our Alien episode, but I think we should do it in person.
I would like that. I think that's maybe we should, we'll work it out, whether we still do Jesse James as the first of next year. Is that, oh no, we've got Ocean's 13 first, don't we?
So it won't
be.
That's
a shame.
So that's fine. We'll work it out.
Well, yeah, I would very much like to do Alien in person.
Yeah, me too. And Jesse James in person. These things will be important.
Yeah.
So we'll, all of that will depend, that will change when we speak to you next, but it's hopefully pretty soon. I think so. I think we should just briefly shout out, like, the family, the Pitcast family, that are extremely dear to us and important to us.
I think that would be lovely.
Merry Christmas to Haley, past and future guest, wonderful friend of the podcast. Desi, incredible friend of the podcast. Juliet, incredible friend of the podcast. Liam, incredible friend of the podcast, from very early, right? Extremely early. Yeah. There are some of these people have been with us since we dropped the first episode. Eva, new friend of the show, deeply valued and cherished member of the show. Bernhard, also new member of the family, extremely and deeply valued member of the family.
Xavier, our most recurring guest.
Our most recurring guest by far. Probably coming back pretty soon for Megamind. The guest who pushed the episode as long as it could possibly go, probably. Like, there's no way we could have talked about Sinbad for anything more than, like, 2 hours and 20 minutes, and he wrung, like, every single one out of us. Incredible.
We had show and tell with the toys.
We had show and tell with the toys, exactly. Aiden, very good friend of the show, been there for a very long time.
I am sitting in an extremely hot room with closed doors, and I am blanking, and I am sure there are people where...
Your mother?
My mother is a committed listener, and often asks about the show. I am recording this in my childhood bedroom. I will, just give me a second, I'll keep talking, hopefully you'll be able to still hear me. She took a bunch of, like, posters and things down when she was tidying my room that had been up since I lived here. And I had mentioned last week that I was, there it is. I just dropped a thumbtack.
Oh, no.
I once stepped on one as a child, so I have trauma around that.
Mm.
And she said she had, like, taken down a bunch of stuff, and then she was listening to the podcast and then heard me talk about the fact I have these postcards.
Oh my goodness. Dan's got the trois color white postcard.
Films I've never seen. And I took a lot of stuff from the local Palace cinemas. I would just have all these cards that they had in their lobby or whatever and just take them and put them in my room for some reason.
Incredible.
Very, like, scattered cultural consumption.
Incredible.
I've got blue up there as well, but this is the white one that I brought to show Joe.
Wonderful. I love it.
But
Rhiannon, another extremely good friend of the show. Susie?
Susie and William Craig, yeah, my dear friends. Yeah, of course, thank you. Will, I would especially have Susie emailed us, for those who haven't listened, I can't remember what episode it is on, sadly, but told us about pain response in watching films from a doctor's perspective, which was extremely interesting. And Will has sent a series of extraordinarily detailed and exquisite emails. I would encourage him to email again if he gets to this episode.
Yeah, fantastic. And if you...
All our listeners who we don't know.
Yeah.
Of which there are a number.
Yeah.
And I would encourage you to have us know you by emailing us at thebradpickcast@gmail.com.
We'd love to know you. It is particularly when I'm editing. I'm often editing and thinking like, oh, I wonder what, you know, so-and-so thinks. And like, you become part of the collective imagination of the show when you email us. So email us. We'd love to hear from you. Rate, review, subscribe.
Yes. On iTunes. And follow us on Twitter at Brad Pittcast.
Yeah. And here's to... we will be pending an international crisis that I maybe shouldn't evoke, given how this world has been.
Yeah.
We'll be done with... We won't... This. We will not have another year of Brad Pitt, unless something crazy happens, like...
I think that's true. Yeah, I think that Brad Pitt... And Brad Pitt makes a lot of films all of a sudden. That could be the other possibility. Outpaces us.
If Brad just says, I've actually secretly been making an additional film a year since 1990 fucking whatever, here they all are.
Yeah, I think Brad Pitt should... I mean, I'm still way too early to think what we do with the name, but Pittcast is Brad Pitt it out maybe in 2021.
Hmm. Exactly. Change.
I also want to thank Joseph for doing this podcast with me, and also has had exclusive for some time, been the exclusive editor of this show and done an extraordinary job.
I love editing this show. I have such a good time doing it. I really do.
And just, I want to say how much I deeply appreciate you, Joe. Oh. And your driving of this, often driving of this show.
I gotta say thank you to my friend Daniel Dixon. I realized terribly, Desi, like, emailed the show. Well, how? Desi contacted us somehow and said, like, I love it when...
It was an email, I think.
I love it when Joe says, my friend Daniel Dixon. And for one reason...
Oh, no, sorry to correct you. It was a review on iTunes. It was a very funny review on iTunes.
Of course. And I would, yeah, and I realized after I read that review, I kind of stopped saying my friend Daniel Dixon. Not on purpose. It just fell out of my lexicon. So I'm bringing it back. A thank you to my friend Daniel Dixon, who's been doing this with me for 40 episodes. Each episode is about 2 hours long. So what, 80 hours of us on the record? What a joy. Who else would I do such a thing with? Who else would I do such a thing with?
Oh boy. I think 2021 will be, this is kind of not, I mean, this doesn't really matter for our listeners, but I'm really genuinely interested to see how the listenership responds to more popular Brad Pitt films.
Yeah.
Also sometimes, like, we see how many people listen to each episode. Episodes that you do not expect massively outperform quite popular films sometimes. So it's not always what you think, but when we're doing, like, you know, Moneyball, Benjamin Button, Inglourious Basterds, etc.
Yeah.
Films people have seen, what happens then?
It's an extremely good question. You're right. Weird films do very well. I mean, for a while there, fucking Legends of the Fall was our most popular episode. And I can't account for why that happened.
Impossible.
A mystery. Is that the best Brad Pitt moment from a film we've covered this year? Is Brad getting his head eaten by a bear?
Maybe that's why it's a really good moment. That isn't in. That adds a solid, like, 50% to the quality of that film.
Oh, 100%. There's just the whole end of that film. Like, Anthony Hopkins drawing a gun in slow motion. Brad Pitt getting eaten by a bear in freeze frame. Just, what a joy we had.
Yeah. Probably a pretty bad film.
Yeah.
Suddenly becomes insane and
magisterial. Pretty,
yeah, like, very watchable. Genuinely magisterial.
Yeah. We'll speak to you very soon. We'll speak to you in 2021. And
happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Take care of yourselves. And hopefully for all of us, 2021 will be a better year than 2020 was. And hopefully, we've had a few people saying that they have enjoyed listening to us well, especially not Australian listeners overseas enjoyed listening to us while cooped up, and hopefully you'll continue to listen to us when you no longer have to be.
Yeah, and hopefully you no longer have to be.
Yeah.
Love you very much.
Love you, everybody. Take care.
See you soon.
Bye.